I'm Jerry Mander. I'm the president of the International Forum on Globalization. I want to welcome everybody here. And before we get started, I'd like to introduce Reverend Philip Wogerman, who's the pastor of this wonderful church. We thank him so much for allowing us to do this event here. And he wants to welcome everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Mander. And it is a pleasure to welcome you here today. I think up front I need to acknowledge a little limiting problem. Your numbers will be very great today, more than we had thought. Our facilities are not instantly expandable, and I'm referring now to the facilities of necessity. We'll keep it supplied. But bear that in mind compassionately as you reflect upon Foundry Church. We do the best we can. And I am pleased to welcome you to Foundry United Methodist Church. This is an historic church. It was founded in 1814 and the present building from 1904. Through nearly two centuries, Foundry has been dedicated to service in the city. It seeks especially to serve poor and marginalized people, including many who have been rejected in other settings. You will note today that our walk-in mission is going on at the same time in another part of the building. Our church has long been an advocate for peace with justice and for responsible environmental policies and practices in the city and nation and the wider world. For instance, last Sunday, numbers of our people participated in the Jubilee 2000 rally for debt relief in the city. Foundry Church itself is not a sponsor of this teach-in. When the Institute for Policy Studies requested use of our church, we responded positively out of our respect for this neighboring institution and our conviction that these issues are very important. They need widespread and balanced discussion. At the same time, we wish to be clear that Foundry Church is not opposed to the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, or the World Trade Organization. Many thoughtful persons consider their defining missions to be indispensable. Many of their policies and programs are worthy of support by people of goodwill. We do extend our best wishes to you for productive discussions. If there's any way that our staff can be helpful to you today, apart from extending the number of chambers of necessity, which we simply don't have beyond the limited number. But please let us know if there's any way we can be helpful to you. You'll find there's a public telephone. Again, that's limited, but it's at the other end of the building, and there are other kinds of facilities here. And we wish for you a very productive day dealing with issues that are terribly important in the contemporary world. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and again, thanks for the opportunity to be here in this beautiful place. And I want to also thank the co-sponsors for this event, who are, in case I don't want to leave anybody out here, the Institute for Policy Studies, which was very, very helpful throughout in arranging venues and handling a lot of the local issues we had to deal with in Washington, as well as Friends of the Earth, the International Center for Technology Assessment, Global Exchange, Public Citizen, and the 50 Years is Enough Network. And you'll hear from representatives of all these groups while you're here. It's great to see you here. We're going to be capacity full today, for sure. As many of you know, this event was actually sold out almost 2 weeks ago. People will be arriving all morning. And we regret, actually, that we're not going to be able to accommodate more people today. We did try to scramble around over the last week to find an additional venue. And actually, we did arrange with another church just nearby, the First Baptist Church, which is showing a video feed of this event as well. We even tried to arrange additional events at George Washington University Gymnasium, which holds 5,000 people, and probably would fill up in the evening, but as we were negotiating the deal, the police closed down the campus for public events. It's now off limits, and so our apologies to everybody who's not going to be able to get in today, and there are going to be a great many people. Of course, this is the first big event following Seattle, and that was a tremendous victory for most of us. And many people here on the stage and in the room and who are still to come later in the day, you deserve the credit for that. Somebody's phone is going here. And you'll hear a lot from them today and over the weekend. It was a great breakthrough in Seattle, but globalization, of course, is a many-armed creature, and one victory just leads us forward to the next battle. The WTO is only one part of a global triad, or iron triangle, or triple threat, or some say unholy trinity. We've been hearing all these terms to describe it. That also includes the World Bank and the IMF. They all operate in utter secrecy. They're unaccountable to democratic processes. They place the welfare of corporations as a primary value. And they all share a faith in the same ideology of corporate-driven free trade, privatization, deregulation, unrestricted export-driven growth, destruction of local economies, forced conversion via structural adjustment of local and national economies to export systems with absentee owners, global corporations. Most appallingly, they do all these things in the name of helping lift the poor and expanding economic opportunities for people, and continue to say that. But as we can clearly now see, exactly the opposite has been the case. These institutions have presided over a truly disastrous combination of results: environmental destruction on a nearly planetary scale, deliberate undermining of the ability of nations to be self-reliant on food or other key needs, deliberate promotion of debt dependency on banks, destruction of public institutions for public health, social services, education, and many more, and the achievement of the greatest rate of growth in separation between the wealthy and the poor within nations and among them, with growing poverty, hunger, and landlessness, and an endless number of other effects you'll hear described today and tonight. We're hard-pressed to imagine how a global economic system, if it had set out to harm people and harm nature as its goal, could have done a more effective job. They claim free trade would bring a utopia, but it's clearly a utopia for corporations that they had in mind. It's time to say enough is enough. Now we see that under pressure, the bank and the IMF are themselves offering compromises and solutions, but we don't think that the people who caused the problems should be the ones to provide the solutions. The people you'll hear this morning and over the weekend and all day have better answers. 50,000 people in Seattle understood all this, and partly because of them and the great solidarity among third world countries within the meetings, the WTO got nothing that it came for. No new round of negotiations, no expanded powers, no expanded services or agriculture deal, no free logging agreement, no new rules on biotechnology that would have prevented nation states from banning biotechnology, no return of the draconian rules of the MAI, no universal codification of a ban on all taxes on e-commerce, which would have absolutely devastated third world countries and small businesses here and everywhere. No codification of the WTO's superiority to the multilateral environmental agreements, such as the Kyoto Climate Change Agreement and the Montreal Protocol. The WTO ministers got nothing in Seattle. Once they were calling the WTO the new constitution for a global society, but they're not saying that now. The WTO was wounded in Seattle. It may never be the same, and now it's our job to keep the pressure up here to tell the rest of the story. So you'll hear about 30 speakers today and tonight, each for about more or less 15 minutes, depending on how time works out. They all have somewhat different angles on things, and they're all great. I know you'll have a great time. But before I pass it on to Anuradha Mittal, who hosts the first panel, I need to make a couple quick announcements. First one is that we will not have a lunch break. We will have a one-hour dinner break. As you know, you need a separate ticket to get it in for the evening. Most of you, I believe, have those. There will be a couple of short breaks between each panel of 5 or 10 minutes. If you get hungry, just slip out and come back, but no food in the church. There's a food stand that will be outside starting at 11:30. But no food in the church. There are some places you can get food at 17th and P Street. There are also tables upstairs with information from lots of organizations and a bookstore table as well, so check it out when you can, between events or whenever. So now here's Anuradha Mito to introduce the first panel. Anuradha is one of the foremost human rights and agricultural activists in the world today. She's the author of many books. She's been an active associate with the IFG since we've started. She's now co-director of the Institute for Food and Development Policy in Oakland. She's a fiery activist and a fabulous person. So here's Anuradha Mittal. Thank you.
You know, my activism around the World Bank and the IMF started in the 80s as a college student. And I was working in the slums of Delhi, and we were all organizing around the budget. The Indian government had come up with a budget which did not really reflect the needs of the poor in the country. And this rickshaw puller took me aside, and he explained to me, he told me that you can't just blame the Indian government, you have to understand. And he was talking to me in Hindi, of course, and he says, it's the structural adjustment policies of the World Bank, and I didn't have a clue. So that rickshaw puller started or put me on this track, and I had to find out more. And wherever he is, I hope he is fine, because I would love to tell him. I would love to tell him that in the 80s, when we were organizing in India and around the world, nobody would have thought that all these people will be coming together in the United States, in the belly of the beast, to challenge these institutions. So thank you for being here. And I think we've come a long way, because we know it's no longer about those nations of the South. We know it's about the poor and the hungry in this country as well. What World Bank and IMF has, you know, unleashed on the rest of the world, what we call structural adjustment programs, welfare reform, supply-side economics, Reaganomics, which has continued under the Bush and Clinton administration, what used to be called Thatcherism in England, and it has continued uninterrupted under the new Labour government. It's the same thing. They come from the same logic. Logic which basically hurts the working poor, women, immigrants, people of color, basically working families. However, we are at a very unique point. We are at a juncture where institutions such as the World Bank and IMF that came up, you know, in 44, 40 years later we saw the WTO. It's a unique moment because they all face a crisis of paradigm, a crisis of institutional structure, a crisis of policy. Earlier, if they had a crisis of institutional structure, they did not have a crisis of, you know, of paradigm. They could get away. But they are really vulnerable, and we have made them vulnerable. And this is a time when we need to move in and change those institutions. But before we do that, we need to understand those institutions. Only when we have that understanding, we can come up with a strategy that can actually dismantle and disband those institutions to create institutions which actually meet our needs. Just very recently, it was the World Bank logic in India, which had the government cracking down on the strike of about 100,000 workers of the electricity board. India is a country which has been put on this three-way fast lane of privatization and liberalization and deregulation. Our energy sector, our insurance sector, banking sector, everything is being privatized. And it's not just about the loss of jobs. It's about the revenue from those blue-chip companies that could go into the social programs. World Bank does give loans to India even today for healthcare. And yet we see cholera outbreaks because those programs are mainly used to control the bodies of women for family planning. Because United Nations Population Fund report says that India cannot feed itself. The reason India cannot feed itself is basically Punjab, Haryana, which used to be the granaries of my country, are today producing food for dogs and cats of Europe. Under privatization, we have Royal Canin, a French company, setting up its operation to use our wheat and our cattle for making dog and cat food for Europe. Haryana is growing tulips for Netherlands, and then they tell us we cannot feed ourselves, and therefore the World Bank, so-called Bank of the Poor, will actually come and rescue us. Many of us have come here not to ask for debt relief, but for debt cancellation, for debt which was been paid back by the third world countries already. This is a debt which is owned. We are saying we have been colonized enough, we have paid back our loans. This is money which is owed to us, and this is no longer just the money which is owed by the third world countries, it is owed by the taxpayers of US. When they went out and actually bailed out Indonesia, they actually bailed out Bank of America, not the poor and hungry of Indonesia. And they used your money. They used our money. And we have come together to say enough is enough, and we are going to be challenging that. But as I said, we have to understand these institutions really well so we can hurt them where they need to be hurt and change them. So I'm delighted that this morning we have an excellent panel of experts, people who have worked outside the system, inside the system, have been responsible for making these institutions really vulnerable. So I'm going to first ask Herman Daly, who is a professor at the University of Maryland in School of Public Affairs. From 1988 to 94, he was a senior economist in the Environment Department of the World Bank. He has served as a Ford Foundation visiting professor at the University of Ceará in Brazil, as a research associate at Yale University, and as a senior Fulbright lecturer in Brazil. He has served on board of numerous environmental organizations, and his interest in economic development, population resources, and the environment has resulted in several hundred articles in professional journals, as well as numerous books. He is also somebody who has inspired activists like me because we knew what was going on inside the bank. He's one of those people who has given us hope that there is hope even within the bank. We can work with those colleagues to actually dismantle that institution. So let's give a big hand to Herman Daly, who's dared to be different.
Thank you very much, and it's a real pleasure to be here. I'm very grateful to be a part of this occasion, and especially to be here in Foundry Methodist Church, where it just so happens that I was a member for 5 years of this congregation, and I have for many, many Sundays sat out in the pews where you are, but this is the first time that I've been looking the other way, and I confess that I kind of secretly hoped that I might be speaking from the pulpit over there, but I think, I think this is better. So, and I want to say that even though this is, this teach-in, this event, is basically secular in nature, I'm personally very glad that it's being held in a sanctuary, which is dedicated to the good news of justice, love, liberation, and forgiveness. And so I'm very grateful to the congregation of Foundry Church and to Philip Waugaman for making this available. Well, that's the end of my sermonette. Moved from the sermon now to the lecture. So if you read the newspapers and watch the TV, you get the impression that anyone who opposes globalization must be an isolationist, or even worse, a xenophobe, or even worse, someone who does not share the dream of a world without poverty, along with the World Bank. Nonsense, utter nonsense. I don't know anyone in this movement who is an isolationist or a xenophobe. The relevant conflict is not that. The relevant conflict, I believe, is between globalization and internationalization. The newspapers don't know the difference, and so let's talk about the difference. What is the definition of these terms, and why is the distinction so important? By internationalization, I mean the increasing importance of relationships between and among nations, international trade, international treaties, alliances, protocols, Montreal Protocol, Kyoto Protocol, cultural interchange. All of these relationships among nations become more and more important. However, the basic unit remains the nation. The basic unit of community and within which people cooperate and take responsibility for each other remains the nation, even as relations among nations become increasingly necessary and important. That's internationalization. That was the model on which the Bretton Woods institutions were created in 1944. Globalization is something entirely and radically different. Globalization refers to the global economic integration of many formerly national economies into one global economy. And that takes place by free trade, especially by free capital mobility, and to a far lesser extent, by easy or uncontrolled migration, generally in the interest of cheap labor. So globalization is the effective erasure of national boundaries for economic purposes. National boundaries become porous with respect to the flow of goods, capital, and to an increasing degree, people viewed as cheap labor. So the alternative to globalization, then, is not isolationism or xenophobia. It's rather internationalization, what the Bretton Woods institutions were designed for before their recent subversion by the globalizers. Well, continuing with a somewhat pedantic approach to definitions and all, the word integration, as in global economic integration, which is globalization, the word integration derives from the word integer. Integer means one, complete, or whole. So integration is the act of combining into one whole. And since there can be only one whole, only one unity with reference to which parts are integrated, it follows then that global economic integration logically implies national economic disintegration. The parts of the economy have to be torn out of their national organized context and in order to be reintegrated into the new global context. As the saying goes, to make an omelet, you have to break some eggs. The disintegration of the national egg is necessary to integrate the global omelet. And so while the word integration may have nice vibrations when you talk about it, when you start thinking about the disintegration of national economies and the costs that are consequent upon that, it loses some of its shine. Well, all that I have just said, I believe, was expressed with admirable clarity and brevity by Renato Ruggiero, who was the former Director General of the WTO. And he said the following, quote, "We are no longer writing the rules of interaction among separate national economies. We are writing the constitution of a single global economy." I think this is a clear affirmation of globalization, as I've just defined it, and a clear rejection of internationalization, as just defined. It is also a radical subversion of the basic charter of the Bretton Woods institutions, which was based on internationalization, federation of nations. So, if the IMF, the WTO, and the World Bank have switched, sort of changed their charter, or just thrown away the old charter and said, now we're interested in globalization, if they're no longer serving the interests of their member nations as per their charter, then whose interests are they serving? Well, we're told the interest of the global economy. But that's a great big abstraction. If you look behind that abstraction for the concrete reality, what do you find? I think you find giant corporations, the big fictitious individuals, not real individual workers, peasants, or even middle-class folks. So that's, I think, very important to keep in mind, the distinction between globalization and internationalization. And I'd like to then just briefly consider a few further consequences of moving towards globalization. Globalization undercuts the ability of nations to count all costs, to internalize all environmental and social costs into prices, so that prices really tell the truth about the total sacrifices that are being made in production. Economic integration under free market conditions promotes a standards-lowering competition, or a kind of race to the bottom. The country that does the poorest job of counting all costs ends up with the cheapest product and with the benefit, the competitive advantage in international trade. So, more and more then of world production tends to shift towards those countries that do the poorest job of counting all environmental and social costs, and this leads to a kind of race to the bottom, a sure recipe for reducing efficiency of production rather than increasing it. And as these uncounted externalized costs increase, then the relationship of measured GNP to real welfare becomes worse and worse and a more and more misleading index. Another point that to make on globalization is that fostering global competitive advantage is used as an excuse, frequently in this country and others, an excuse for tolerance of corporate mergers and tolerance of monopoly. The idea is we can't have a competitive market structure in the United States or in some other country because we have to compete in the global market. So we need really big corporations to go out and compete in the global market. And if that means there are going to be monopolies at home, well, you know, too bad, that's what we have to do. Chicago School economist and Nobel laureate Ronald Coase said many years ago in his writing on the theory of the firm that firms and corporations are islands of central planning in a sea of market relationships. The islands of central planning become larger and larger relative to the remaining sea of market relationships. More and more resources are allocated by the within-firm principle of central planning, and less are resources allocated by the between-firm principle of market competitive relationships. And this is hailed as a victory for markets. It's no such thing. It's a victory for corporations relative to national governments, which are no longer strong enough to regulate corporate capital in the public interest. Of the 100 largest economic organizations, 52 are corporations, 48 are nations, a statistic we often hear, but it's extremely important. And the distribution of income within these islands of central planning, within the corporations, is itself becoming much more concentrated. The ratio of salary of chief executive officer to average worker in the corporation has now passed 400 on its way to infinity, and that's probably what we should expect if the chief central planner sets their own salaries. So I don't know about you, but I'm tired of seeing our free market subverted by a bunch of pinko corporate central planners intent on global domination. Another point is that free trade and free capital mobility increase the pressure for specialization according to comparative or competitive advantage among nations. Therefore, the range of choice by which people are able to earn their living, to earn their income, is reduced as you globalize and specialize in this way. And that's a real welfare cost. As an example, if you take the little country of Uruguay, they have a clear comparative advantage in raising sheep and cattle. So according to the comparative advantage doctrine and global integration and fitting the international economy, every Uruguayan has a choice of occupation. He can either be a shepherd or a cowboy. Now, if you want to be an airline pilot or play in a symphony orchestra, too bad. You have to immigrate to some other country because this is a comparative advantage. So this is a tremendous restriction. I mean, that hasn't happened because Uruguay has resisted it. But that's the logic of the system. And trade economists just don't count the welfare loss of restricting the range of choice of occupation among people. Yet I know from students that most of us gain most of our satisfaction in life, more of our satisfaction in life, from the way we earn our income than from the way that we spend it. And so that range of choice is reduced. At the same time, the range of choice of how we spend our income receives enormous overemphasis. They're eager to give us all sorts of choices about how you spend your income. For example, the United States imports Danish butter cookies, and the Danes import U.S. butter cookies. And somewhere over the North Atlantic, the butter cookies pass each other at the expense of a whole lot of fossil fuel. Well, is that really efficient? Is that really a good way to organize the world? Economists say, well, you're being an elitist now. Back off, because cookie connoisseurs really do benefit from the difference between Danish and American butter cookies, and so you're okay. Maybe so. But even if that's the case, wouldn't it be cheaper to just trade recipes? But trading recipes, recipes. That's trade-related intellectual property rights. And that's the one thing that the free traders really want to protect. They don't want to see free trade and information and property rights. But knowledge is, of all things, is the thing that should be most shared, because in sharing knowledge, knowledge is multiplied rather than divided. Thomas Jefferson's statement, knowledge is the common property of mankind. The trade theorists have sort of forgotten that, and they're in the service of creating further corporate monopoly rights on knowledge, which are now supposed to be enforced worldwide through the WTO and all of that. Well, I'll leave that subject to others in the teach-in who know more about it. And I close with my favorite quote from John Maynard Keynes, one of the intellectual founders of the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF and the World Bank. And Keynes, in a speech to people in Ireland, said the following. He said, "I sympathize, therefore, with those who would minimize rather than those who would maximize economic entanglement between nations. Ideas, knowledge, art, hospitality, travel, these are the things which should, of their nature, be international. But let goods be homespun whenever it is reasonably and conveniently possible. And above all, let finance be primarily national." Big difference. Well, it's not my intention here to demonize the IMF, the World Bank, and the WTO. They need total reform. I think the criticisms of they have become autistic and isolated within their habitual assumptions. When the World Bank speaks to us through its annual World Development Report, I think all that one really hears is the unison snoring of supine economists in deep dogmatic slumber. And the aims of the street demonstration, I believe, is not to harm these sleepwalkers, but to wake them up before they cause still more destruction. Thank you.
I told you he's really good. Well, some couple of program changes. First of all, Susan George is not here. She's not well, so she could not join us here. Laurie Wallach has been moved to the last evening panel because of a schedule conflict. Daphne Washam will now be on this panel, moving from the last evening panel. And Danny Kennedy from Project Underground is an added speaker. He insisted. Oh, he wasn't here to hear me say that. Our next speaker is Jyoti Jorege Jehu. Many of us know her because she's been involved with 50 Years is Enough Network for over 4 years. And she became its director in October 98. Working with over 185 international partner organizations in more than 65 countries, the U.S. Network for Global Economic Justice is a project of 50 Years is Enough, which is comprised of over 205 U.S. grassroots, women, solidarity, faith-based, policy, social and economic justice, youth, labor, whichever group you can think of. It's all in there. Jyoti grew up as an active member in the Green Belt movement in her native Kenya. She has testified before the U.S. Congress. She has made multiple presentations on these issues at the U.N. And many of us have seen those mobilizations that are taking place outside. We're going to be kicking their ass, and she's one of the key organizers around that. So Jyoti, give her a big hand.
Thank you. I don't know if you're allowed to say ass in church, but good morning. I'm very excited to be here this morning. I just came from a briefing that our colleagues from the Global South made to the media. If you recall, after Seattle, there was a report from The Economist saying the real losers of Seattle were the developing countries. In the struggle against the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, activists in the United States have always taken the lead from the people at the grassroots, from the people in the Global South, who live and often die from the impacts of the policies of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. This week, today, and for the rest of our lives, we are making a commitment to ensure that these institutions change. I think I would like to tell you that the consensus this morning was that they cannot be reformed, that they have to be abolished. So on Tuesday, when the steering committee of the 50 Years is Enough Network meets, we will have to discuss this because our colleagues have spoken very, very clearly. The oppression is global. Therefore, the resistance and the solidarity has to be global. We have made the connections across sectors, across countries, across regions, across states, across communities. And now, people to people, we are making those connections. It is not workers in the maquiladoras who are the enemies of workers who are losing their jobs in the U.S. The enemy is the multinational corporations, the corporations that are taking away those jobs and ensuring that they give them or they provide those jobs for people in Mexico, in Haiti, in Nicaragua at cents an hour, $2 a day or the rest, or the like. The enemy is not fellow workers around the world. The enemy are the owners of capital, and we need to remember that. In getting ready for the mobilization for global justice, I've been very, very impressed. I've been inspired by the commitment, by the skills and the talents of activists who have spent hours, weeks, days getting ready for this. And I'm really pleased that all of you are here today. Unlike Herman, I don't mind demonizing the World Bank and the IMF. I don't mind at all, and I want to do this so that, you know, I don't know how many people saw the Washington Post yesterday, the workers at the World Bank and the IMF saying, why us? We work so hard. We care so much about poverty. What is wrong with these people? Well, we have spent days in this week. We have spent months and years before this saying why these institutions are wrong, saying what is wrong with international debt, what is wrong with structural adjustment programs, what is wrong with their support of corrupt dictators, what is wrong with their top-down mentality and development model, what is wrong with the economic model that they are pushing forward. We will continue to name the reasons why we are pointing a finger, and my only hope is that their nice salaries ease their pain and help them cope with the accusations, help them cope with the fact that they have caused misery. The best indictment does not come from us. Davidson Buto, who worked 12 years at the IMF, he talked about the blood that covered his hands. He talked about what he had done in the name of the job that he was doing. He said enough was enough. We have taken up the mantle. We are continuing with that demand and saying enough is enough. These institutions cannot be reformed. These institutions are not alleviating poverty. In fact, they have been increasing poverty. Something has to change. Over the next few days, not just in Washington, but in Haiti, in Turkey, in Argentina, New Zealand, Mauritius, the Philippines, in many, many communities and many countries, people are also doing things similar to what we are doing here. It is not the Washington consensus. This is not the Washington consensus. It is the people's consensus. These institutions have to change. These institutions have to adapt. These institutions have to listen. Otherwise, they are out, and we will send our tax dollars some other place to some other institution that does the will of the people, that ensures that the weakest, the poorest, the environment, working people, women, children are protected. They do not become mere pawns in a global economy that transfers wealth from poor countries and poor people to multinational corporations. Scholar activist Howard Zinn asked the question, what a difference would it make in our lives if instead of every day hearing about how the Dow Jones Industrial Average did, we every day heard about the 34,000 children who die from preventable and curable diseases. They die because they don't have access to clean water, because they don't have access to immunization. So instead of every newscast talking about the Dow Jones up, down, just about the same today, 34,000 children died today from preventable and curable diseases. It is genocide. Over 12 million children die every year. I don't know how many of us know this. I don't know how many of us reflect on these kinds of thoughts as we think about why we are out in the streets, why we are spending long hours working, why we are taking a week of vacation or taking time out of our lives to be here. Fighting for justice is not a choice. It's the moral imperative. I want to talk about 3 points about what the World Bank and the IMF are up to and then conclude. Structural adjustment programs. They ask why the finger is being pointed at them. Under structural adjustment program for over 20 years now, in about 90 countries, we have seen the health sector, the education sector, nutrition programs, credit for farmers, the productive and reproductive capacities of women completely decimated. And I, for one, choose to lay all of that on the front step of the World Bank and the IMF. They are responsible for that. And we have to say that. They say, how can you blame this on us? They are responsible for it. They say that they follow the guidance and the directive of the governments, of their members who are governments. They are public institutions. Their members may be governments, but it is your tax dollars and mine that are paying for those. Under structural adjustment programs, We who live in the United States and other enriched countries are benefiting from the system. We are able to get cheap goods across about a block and a half from here at the Safeway. I'm able to get Costa Rican bananas for 69 cents a pound. I grew up on a farm. I know what it takes to raise crops like bananas. And I'm very, very much aware that that pound of bananas costing me 69 cents means that somebody has been massively exploited. And therefore, with that realization comes a responsibility and an obligation for us to say, no, this has to stop. How many people in this room know the name of their representative at the World Bank or at the IMF? Show of hands. The name of your representative at the World Bank or the IMF? Yes, you do. Show of hands. I want to see this. This is appalling. I want all of us to leave here and do the research and find out. It doesn't matter what country you're from. You do have one. You do have a representative. You do have a representative at the World Bank, an executive director representing the U.S. at the IMF, an executive director representing the United States. And so, if nothing else, on Tuesday morning, by Tuesday morning, this is your assignment. I used to be a teacher and you give deadlines. By Tuesday morning, every one of you should have gotten on the World Bank website, www.worldbank.org, on the IMF website, www.imf.org, and you know the name of your representative at those institutions, you know their address, their email, their phone and fax number. And by a week from Tuesday, you will have sent a message, I don't care how, to them, telling them why you came to Washington and what you want them to do. Do we have agreement on this? Thank you. Thank you. I went to a meeting at the IMF about a month and a half ago, and the head of the PR department said he doesn't hear enough from people around the world. Well, I told him that he was going to be sorry. Please don't make a liar out of me. I want to very quickly talk about international debt. There's a fantastic movement called the Jubilee 2000 movement. In over 50 countries, there are national campaigns. In over 100 countries, over 17 million people have signed petitions demanding debt cancellation. So we know that the people want this. People want debt cancellation. Mr. Wolfenson would have us believe that he, as he has said, quote, we invented the notion of debt relief. I beg to differ. At a forum where I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan a few weeks ago, the guy who is head of the HIPC initiative, the Heavily Indebted Poor Countries initiative of the World Bank and the IMF, said that I know he was speaking metaphorically, but, you know, he should do better than that. He said that there were 12 people, he thinks there are 12 people in the entire world who are interested in debt. I said, well, I know it was a metaphor, but you are very wrong. 17 million people signed the petition. The initiative that the World Bank and the IMF have put forward still links debt relief to structural adjustment programs. The people of the Global South have said it is a poison chalice and they are not going to take a sip from it. Your job, my job, is to make sure that the United States Congress, the U.S. Treasury, the representative at the World Bank and the IMF understand this. Debt relief linked to structural adjustment program is a poison chalice, and the people of the South will have none of it. The South African Council of Churches in Cologne, when the G7 announced a new debt relief, the son of HIPC, daughter of HIPC, I don't know, you know, HIPC 2, the South African Council of Churches said that the new HIPC initiative merely polishes rather than breaks the chains of debt. We want to break the chains of debt. Let's be very clear about that. The Banking Committee last year voted to delink structural adjustment programs from debt relief. it has been swallowed up in the way that Congress swallows up the will of the people. We have to remind them. And the last point that I want to make is this. On April 16th, we will be out on the lips, we will be outside on the doors of the World Bank and the IMF. The IMF has to understand that the concerns that people have expressed about structural adjustment programs, about the treadmill that the HIPC initiative is, are serious concerns. We have total resolve of ensuring that the injustice does not continue. We have total resolve of ensuring that these institutions are held accountable. And I very, very quickly want to say, you know, the media is asking, why are you here? What is this about? I want very quickly to read to you the demands of the 50 Years is Enough Network to these institutions. On the occasion of these meetings, they have been signed on by hundreds of people and organizations around the world. It is important that they know what we are demanding. Some of my other colleagues will be talking about the alternatives that we are putting forward to replace what the World Bank and the IMF offers us. And so my job here in closing is to tell you what we are demanding. If you want to sign on to this, I encourage you to do that. One, that the IMF and World Bank cancel all the debts owed to them. I want to hear your applause if you agree, by the way. Thank you. That the IMF and World Bank immediately cease imposing the economic austerity measures known as structural adjustment programs. That the IMF and World Bank accept responsibility for the disastrous impact of structural adjustment policies by paying reparations to the people and communities who have borne that impact. That the World Bank Group pay reparations to people relocated and otherwise harmed by its large projects, such as dams, and compensate governments for repayments made on projects which World Bank evaluations rank as economic failures. That the World Bank Group immediately cease providing advice and resources through its division devoted to private sector investment to advance the goals associated with corporate globalization. The next one is an important one, and I really want to know what people think. I know I'm out of time. That the agencies and individuals within the World Bank Group and IMF complicit in abetting corruption as well as their accomplices in borrowing countries be prosecuted, and that those responsible, including the institutions involved, provide compensation for resources stolen and damage done. And lastly, that the future existence, structure and policies of international institutions such as the World Bank Group and the IMF be determined through a democratic, participatory and transparent process. Somebody from the World Bank asked, I'm surprised, he said, it doesn't say anything about public flogging of World Bank and IMF policies. It's in the fine print. Thank you.
Now you know why I said kicking ass. I want to apologize to anyone whose sensibilities were offended by me saying that I grew up as a Hindu, and as a Hindu I know God as a creator, a nurturer, and a destroyer. And in her sanctuary, I think it's okay to say kick an ass. And many of us read the article in Washington Post yesterday that Jyoti referred to, like, but why us? We are ending poverty. It also said that it has 11,300 employees, and I think very well, we know very well whose poverty is being ended here. If you start looking at the salaries and the rest, at the cost of the poor and the third world people. Our next speaker is Daphne Weisham, who coordinates the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, a project of the Institute for Policy Studies and the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. Born and raised in India, Daphne's current research and activism is focused on equity and sustainability as it relates to international financial institutions. and export credit agencies, multinational corporations, fossil fuels, indigenous people, human rights, and climate change. She's a former editor-in-chief of Greenpeace magazine. She's the co-editor of a book on the 50th anniversary of the World Bank called Beyond Bretton Woods, Alternatives to the Global Economic Order with IPS Director John Kavanagh. Her articles and research have been featured in the New York Times, on CNN, NPR, and Pacifica, in San Jose Mercury News, Knight Ridder Wire, In the Nation, Ecologist, and The Guardian, among many others. So, Daphne.
Good morning. It's a great honor to stand before you here during one of the most important movements of our lives, the movement for global social and environmental justice. I want to tell you today about one of the World Bank's largest areas of lending activity, one that has a significant impact both on present and future generations. It's lending in support of oil, gas, and coal mining around the world. As you probably know, burning fossil fuels is already affecting the stability of our climate. Climate change, as it has been said, is second only to global nuclear war in the threat it poses to the global ecosystems, and the poorest in developing countries are at greatest risk. We only need to read the papers to see the death sentence weather-related disasters are imposing right now on the poorest around the world. Today, it's Ethiopia, where a three-year drought means the last source of nutrition for children, camel's milk, has dried up along with the land, resulting in hundreds of infant deaths. We've seen images in our morning papers of women and children in Mozambique and other parts of southern Africa holding on to fragile treetops and rooftops as the floodwaters rise. Then there's the storms and flooding of Hurricane Mitch that ravaged Central American countries within the last few years. And we here in the U.S. complain that our oil prices are rising by a few cents. But the price of our fossil fuel consumption is being paid right now in lost lives by the poorest people around the world. This is a form of ecological debt of the worst kind that we owe the Global South. The time that we live in... The time that we live in is a critical time in many ways. In climate terms, we have a small window of opportunity to either invest in clean, renewable forms of energy and energy efficiency in developing countries where the energy infrastructure has not yet been built, or we commit ourselves as a planet to an even more rapidly warming globe. The World Bank knows this. They know it very well. They also know that the poorest are at greatest risk of starvation, disease, and death as the planet warms. So what are they doing about it? Well, at IPS, we did a study. We analyzed World Bank energy lending over a six-year period, beginning at the Earth Summit of 1992 and continuing through 1998. What we discovered was the following. Between 92 and 1998, the World Bank has invested over $14 billion in oil, gas, and coal projects around the world. These same projects, financed only over a six-year period, will release greenhouse gas emissions over their lifetimes that are more than all current global greenhouse gas emissions for all of the world's countries for 1 year. One in three of these fossil fuel projects is powering dirty coal-fired power plants in China. Within the World Bank's energy and power lending, three-quarters of its money, 76%, is devoted to fossil fuels. The bank is now investing roughly 25 times as much on fossil fuels as it is on renewables and energy efficiency. And not surprisingly, 9 out of 10 of these projects benefit corporations based in the powerful G7 countries. Corporations like ExxonMobil, Amoco, Shell, and BP. I'd like to tell you just about two projects in particular that are exemplary of the World Bank's fossil fuel lending. One is the Chad Cameroon Pipeline Project, a project that is going to be coming to the World Bank's Board of Directors very soon, probably in the next couple of weeks. This project will partner a $540 million World Bank loan package with some of the largest corporations on the planet, including ExxonMobil, Chevron Corporation, and Petronas, and two of the most corrupt governments in the world. ExxonMobil is one of the corporations most adamantly opposed to any action by the U.S. on climate change. Exxon CEO Lee Raymond warned China a couple years ago that signing the Kyoto Protocol would harm its economy. He then turned around and told the U.S. Congress, via the Anti-Environmental Global Climate Coalition, to take no action on the Kyoto Protocol until countries like India and China do. Chevron is a U.S. company that has admitted to Congressman Dennis Kucinich that it provided the helicopters and boats on two separate occasions in 1998 and 1999 to transport Nigerian troops who shot and killed unarmed demonstrators. The demonstrators were demanding clean air, clean water, their basic rights. This project, this Chad Cameron pipeline project, financed by the World Bank, threatens to create another Niger Delta nightmare in Chad and Cameroon. But it's moving forward despite some of the most vocal criticisms and protests ever heard about a project from civil society groups around the world. Among the critics were a group of Harvard Law School students who critiqued the World Bank's proposed revenue sharing agreement for the Chad Cameroon pipeline as naive and unworkable. The World Bank, in response, sent two of its staffers up to Cambridge to meet with the head of the Harvard Law School. They demanded that the professor in charge of this class of students be fired. I can't remember the professor's name. I'll get back to you on that. The second example I'd like to share with you involves coal mining in eastern India. Until recently, India was the top recipient of World Bank development dollars, China now is, and coal the bank's number one investment in India. The bank justifies expanded coal mining in India as not only good for the economy, but also as good for the environment, if the bank's involved. The World Bank is financing 25 mines out of 400 new open-cast coal mines in eastern India. The environmental devastation in the vicinity of these mines is total. These regions of India contain many of the last remaining wild tigers on Earth, as well as other endangered species, including the Asiatic elephant. The forests are unique because they are still connected by fragile but working corridors that allow large mammals like tigers the migration range they need. The planned mines will cut off the corridors, reducing the forest to islands surrounded by human activity. The stranded tiger populations of inside these forest islands will die out. But it's not just endangered species we're talking about. It's also endangered indigenous cultures in the region. To make way for the mines, entire villages of tribal people have been forcibly evicted and resettled under inhumane conditions. Whereas once they had land, now they have none, and no jobs are offered to most of the oustees. When the coal and the money run out, vast areas of the region will be laid waste, devoid of its indigenous communities and wildlife, and all too soon of its short-lived mining economy. When we've met with the World Bank officials and we've asked why, in the face of the evidence that climate change will harm the poorest, in the face of the evidence that oil, gas, and coal mining is already harming the poorest in countries around the world, why they continue to subsidize fossil fuels, they respond in one of two ways. In this circular form of reasoning, they say the poor are poor because they don't have access to cheap fossil fuels. Therefore, it's the bank's duty to make them less poor, and the only way to do that is by continuing to subsidize fossil fuels. Wolfensohn also likes to point out, when questioned on this particular issue, that countries like India have plenty of coal, and we can't expect them not to use it, which is a powerful argument. But why, then, is the World Bank facilitating the import of Australian coal to India's coal burners? Imagine what the World Bank could accomplish if it diverted only the $540 million that it's now investing in the Chad Cameroon pipeline to genuinely sustainable development initiatives. It could provide solar panels and cookers to villages throughout the region. In doing so, it could avoid making the same mistakes that in Chad and Cameroon that transformed Nigeria from a once diverse economy where per capita income was above $2,000 to the impoverished nation it is today, where oil provides most of the government's budget, yet per capita income is one-tenth what it was in the 1960s. The World Bank could single-handedly drive down the price of renewables and make them more accessible to the people who need them the most, the poorest in rural areas. It could do this by investing the $2 billion it spends right now on fossil fuels in renewables and energy efficiency every year. The good news is that groups around the world, people like you, are organizing against these fossil fuel projects and other projects financed by the World Bank. We're telling the World Bank and other public banks that use public funds to get out of fossil fuel lending now. But we need more numbers. We need more people writing letters, as Jokey said, to our executive directors at the World Bank and the IMF. We need more people raising these issues with Congress, more sustained activism. We've got a sign-up sheet upstairs at the IPS table that I'd encourage people to sign up and join our efforts to get these banks out of fossil fuel lending. And I'll close there. Thank you.